It's early morning and you want to get your banjos dueling. But maybe you don't live in some highfalutin city where you can just get a great cup of coffee anytime you want. And even if you did, there'd be no guarantee that the proprietors of your local cafe practice real quality control. Not to worry. Sparkplug is here and they deliver high quality coffee to you wherever you are, guaranteed fresh. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and a rotating feature blend for the more adventurous of you out there. But the best part is that they deliver this coffee to your home or office or riverside shanty within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. So why are you still settling for mediocre coffee? Sparkplug even offers autopilot set-it-and-forget-it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
My Riverside address is 1 Riverside Drive. Because you can drive on this river.
Ding, 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 ding.
Da-da-ding, ding, 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 ding. Hit it.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hiya, film people of all shapes and sizes, and thank you for devoting some of your day to the Next 100 Project, the nearly every Monday podcast that analyzes classic movies. Our intense, in-depth, and downright incredible analysis includes insane amounts of spoilage. I'm your host in these whitewater rapid adventures, and with me, as always, is my bravura wife, the woman who can defeat anything other than a compound fracture, and her name is Bev.
That's me.
All right, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Deliverance. Name at least one movie other than Deliverance that fulfills the following for these four actors. John Voight is haunted by a trauma. Burt Reynolds finds himself in mortal danger in a body of water. Ronnie Cox dies brutally. And Ned Beatty doesn't get raped.
I'll start with the easy one.
The answer is all of them. We hope.
Ned Beatty, I'll say Network because we covered Network in a previous podcast. He gives that amazing speech about messing with the forces of nature. You can do it better than me. John Voight, also an AFI film, Midnight Cowboy, where he is haunted by what we assume to be sexual abuse in his childhood.
I was thinking of Coming Home, by the way, but that works too.
Okay.
Midnight Cowboy does. Coming Home, where he's a Vietnam veteran who is haunted by the trauma of the war.
For Ronnie Cox, RoboCop.
Or Total Recall, where both are brutal.
It's been so long since I've seen Total Recall, but RoboCop has an amazing death right at the end of the film where he shoots them so dramatically they
you're
fall
fired!
Out the window.
Thank you.
It's just violent over and over again. Yeah. It's amazing.
Well, both these movies are Paul Verhoeven, RoboCop and Total Recall.
Yes.
And Total Recall is the one where he dies on Mars, where he strangles himself out on the Martian.
Oh, is he like an eye-popping death?
That's right.
Oh, good job, Ronnie Cox. Burt Reynolds, I had to look up because no Burt Reynolds movie that I've seen has had him in Danger in the Water. And I am merely guessing that he was in peril on the water in the movie Shark from 1969.
That could be.
Listen, according to the IMDb description, he was.
That's probably a good answer, but I was thinking about the end.
We're
at the end of the movie. He's saying all kinds of platitudes, and it's a funny little ending where he's vowing to do all these great things if he'll just be saved. It's a comedy. But your answer probably is valid, too. The whole point of that joke, actually, was for the Ned Beatty thing.
I know.
Because that is the most famous part of this movie, along with the joyful dueling banjos. We'll talk about both of those in a moment. But the Next 100 Project's 70th motion picture, Deliverance, was nominated for both the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. And it didn't make it, and that's a little depressing because it should have. Warner's cut the flick loose a day over 45 years ago on July 30th, 1972. For a movie with so much location shooting, it didn't cost that much, and it made quite a bit of money. But better remind people what it's about with the Deliverance Skinny.
It's man versus nature, city versus country, and insurance salesman versus hillbilly in the deep backwoods of Georgia, where four men come looking for adventure and find themselves stalked and tormented by local mountain men. When tough guy Lewis, played by Burt Reynolds, is hurt, John Voight's Ed must step up and do the unthinkable to save himself and his friends.
Or in a nutshell, Apocalypse Now is right. Never get out of the boat. Or worst Saturday ever.
This is why I never go camping.
Well, I say we're Saturday because it does take place on Saturday. They go out on the river on a Friday. They camp out for the night, and the next day when all the bad stuff happens is a Saturday. All right, well, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 93% of critics still like the movie, 51 fresh, only 4 rotten, and 82% of audiences, so a bit of a difference there. I don't know why so many fewer audience members like the movie, but they're wrong. The movie was 5th at the 1972 U.S. box office. The Godfather was number 1 and was, of course, the Best Picture winner and probably the most lauded film of all time. And Cabaret, which we also covered for the Top 100 project, was number 7 and was also pretty lauded that year. So the movie that was shot mostly in sequence on the Cahuillawassee River, which was actually the Chattooga River, is still one of my favorites from the 70s, but it's not a lot of fun. It's a very dark movie, but a very gutsy movie, I think, too. What did you think of it?
I agree. This is a film I can say with confidence was robbed of its rightful place on the AFI's list of greatest films. It's smart, it's brave, it's beautiful, and it's a masterpiece of storytelling. It possibly suffered for being a little ahead of its time, and also being a little too effective, considering the subject matter, because it really gets under your skin.
You're talking about the rape, aren't you?
Yes. The rape is an incredibly hard scene to watch that would make anybody uncomfortable, and I wonder if it was effective enough to turn viewers off and make them not want to like the movie.
It still turned out in big droves that year to watch it, though.
Yeah, I'm still surprised that it was a popular movie, that it made a lot of money.
John Voight's name was still big. Burt Reynolds was getting big. That's got to be a big part of it. Star power.
I guess so. I mean, stars make bombs all the time. And true. Star power or not, I'm sure people knew before they went to the movies, a guy gets raped. I mean, Squeal Like a Pig is by far the most... It was like the only thing I knew about this movie for years before I saw it. As a matter of fact, the first time I saw it years ago with you, I was alarmed at how serious the rape scene was because it's turned into such a joke that I wasn't remotely emotionally prepared for how serious and how realistic the rape scene is. There's just something about it that feels... too strikingly believable.
You know why? Is because all the parodies just deal with the actual moment. But in the movie, it builds. When Ed and Bobby come across the two mountain men, they're trying to just be cool with them, they're trying to be okay with it. Oh, we'll laugh this off. We'll give you money if we have to. If we want your money, we'll take it! And when they say that, I think that's when people start realizing, oh, this is going to be bad. Because why are they doing this? That's one of the questions I was going to ask for later. I'll bring it up right now. Why do they rape Bobby? And why were they going to rape Ed? Just because they can? Are they gay? Are they hiding a still, which Bobby suggests? If you got a still, we'll buy some liquor from you. Why do they do it?
So I thought about this a great deal. First of all, there's not actually a ton of buildup. The whole scene, it's like a minute.
That's still more buildup than people ever put in their parodies of the scene.
Okay, yeah, yeah. The moment you really know things are going to get ugly is when the mountain man strokes Bobby's face in this gentle, caressing manner in the most insidious and violent caress in film.
And then makes him strip.
But even before that, just the look on Bobby's face, and Ned Beatty gives such a great performance of bewilderment and suddenly feeling very threatened. My guess of why they did it, something that the movie kind of touches on but doesn't really get deep into, which is what is happening to the mountain man? What is happening to the people who live in this river valley, who are having everything they own, their whole way of life, stripped of them so that these assholes in the city can make more money. Now, of course, it's not Bobby and Ed who are making more money, but they do symbolize the powers that be that are just carelessly stripping their land and their life away from them. So they have a really good reason to hate these people, whether they were aware of who Ed and Bobby were. But Ed and Bobby and Lewis and Drew, they show up to this town and they're just throwing their weight around and treating them like idiots and being condescending assholes right from the moment they get there. So I think these men just have a really good reason to have contempt, and that rape is a revenge rape.
You rape our land, we're going to rape you.
Exactly.
And rich fucks getting what they deserve. Now, these guys aren't rich, Ed, Lewis, Drew, and Bobby, by rich standards, but by the standards of this area, they are rolling in the dough.
Yeah, and they're all Georgians, but they live worlds apart. And that's something, that's a picture that they paint for us right from the very beginning, is the contrast between these four men from the city and the locals in this place that they're coming to have their just little canoeing adventure, like, oh, we're going to be so tough, we're going to take this river. The contempt that they show the mountain people with the way that they talk to them and treat them is embarrassing. And it's funny because this is my second time seeing the movie. And I said to you when we were watching it, how striking it is watching it for a second time when you really pay attention to the men's attitudes towards the locals and just how bad they are. When you know what's going to happen to them and how much they're going to get humbled, it's quite striking.
Even Drew, the nicest of the four of them, the best of us, as it turns out, as Ed says about him when he's dead, he says to Bobby, "Let's not upset these people." Well, the question becomes, what do you mean, these people? Because he does say it with, well, he actually doesn't say it with a tone the way that Bobby does. But even the nice guy, Drew, who clicks with the kid in the dueling banjo sequence not long before, is saying, these people.
He's representing the oblivious one who's like, look, I'm nice to them. I have respect for them. I'm playing banjo with this kid. What? He doesn't want to shake my hand? The obliviousness of not understanding why they might hate them.
You know how they got that shot? Apparently, for whatever reason, Billy Redden, who played that kid who plays the banjo, didn't like Ned Beatty. So Beatty comes into the frame for no good reason, and that's why the kid turns away from Ronnie Cox the way he does.
Really?
Yeah.
So apparently the kid was not dumb at all. They cast him because he looks so strange.
Looks a little inbred.
And he told the director when he was being friendly with them, like, oh yeah, everyone assumes that I'm stupid just because of the way I look, but there was nothing wrong with him. But he didn't play the banjo.
That's right.
That was a trick shot where they had somebody else's arm coming out through his shirt on the fret. I think that the kid, Billy, you said his name was?
Billy Redden.
He was doing the strumming.
Oh, he had to. You can see his right arm, but yeah. You can't. Well, I never picked up on this until I read about it a few years ago in the IMDb trivia. That he's not playing the chords, but he is playing... Wait, have I got that backwards? He's playing the right hand, but he's not playing the left
hand. Yeah, that's right. And he's not necessarily a good actor, but he's great casting as far as his looks. Because there is something strange about the way he looks. And about all of them. It was good casting in that respect. Some people who are actually from that valley took offense by their portrayal. And, rightly so.
There's a doppelganger at the end, though, because when they get out of the river... There's a kid, it's not supposed to be the Billy Redden character all over again, but he does look somewhat like him when they come across him and then they help him out. You see that church that's about to be taken away on a truck, and then later on in the movie, right towards the end of the film, you see that church being transported out. Nice touch, by the way, one of the last things we see being taken out of that area is a graveyard. They're digging up all the caskets. Very unsubtle. This movie's not subtle. James Dickey wrote the book. It was a 1970 novel that he wrote, and he wrote his only screenplay in this movie as well. His only feature film screenplay, at least. He also plays a sheriff at the end, and he and the director, John Boorman, had a literal fist fight, I was reading, on set.
He knocked his teeth out.
But they managed to make up, and they became friends, and...
He was a heavy drinker. They had to work with him a certain way, because if they just let him get anywhere near a bar, it was over.
Yeah. Well, clearly the Burt Reynolds character is based on him, and you can see in the making of that Dickey and Reynolds are working together, especially with that crossbow, because Dickey looks like a natural with it, as does Burt Reynolds. He's incredible with that crossbow. He seems like he's been shooting it all of his life. John Voight looks fine with it too, but then he's supposed to play scared with the deer sequence early on when he can't shoot it, and then towards the end when he's pointing at a man and still can't shoot it until he actually just accidentally does. But when Burt Reynolds has it standing in that canoe and about to shoot a fish, I may be a straight man, but holy shit, that was a sexy moment.
He's got that hairy chest coming out from that weird shirt that he's wearing. What is that shirt, anyway? At first I thought it was scuba gear somehow.
It does look kind of scuba-esque.
But it's not. It's just like a weird rubber shirt.
Well, the Lewis character obviously wants to be a woodsman. He's one with the land, but he's also melodramatic. He's, I think, clearly going through a pre-midlife crisis. Not quite midlife, maybe, but pre. He's obsessed with this river. And in the end, he fakes amnesia. So he's got a very interesting, in some ways, weird arc, but he is the stand-in for the author of the book. I don't think that from whatever I've ever seen about James Dickey that he relates to Ed as much as he relates to Lewis.
Maybe. He apparently would get drunk and confess to each and every member of the cast, everything in the book happened to me. And he kept telling them that. But then Boorman said he had his doubts that the story was true. And he said the second he saw him in a canoe paddling around, he was like, oh no. There's no way. No way this man has any experience in a canoe. So who knows? It's still kind of a mystery. He's a pretty interesting character, Dickie.
Yeah.
Lewis is this hyper-masculine and performatively masculine character. He's speeding. He's aggressively negotiating with the locals.
Not take directions.
Will not take directions.
Such a man.
I know. That's such a funny, stereotypical thing. He smokes a cigar where Ed smokes a pipe. And he seems like actually the one who's relatively unaffected by everything when it's all said and done and he's in the hospital. There's a threat that he's going to lose his leg, and he still seems to be in pretty positive spirits.
I think it's interesting that of the four of them, the one who might be the best off long term, though, the guy who got raped. Lewis may be second on that list because you're right. He may be back out in some adventure within a few months or even a few days or weeks, knowing him.
He was dying to kill somebody. That's not traumatic to him. He has a speech where he's like, when civilization comes to a crashing halt, you know, I'll be the one who can take care of us. And Ed looks at him and says, you want civilization.
But if he loses that leg, it's a little different story that he can actually achieve those things.
And that would be probably pretty hard for him to handle. But as far as the trauma of committing a murder, he bounces back from that immediately. Yeah. As a matter of fact, the one who seems to take it the very worst is Drew, who had the least to do with any of that.
The one who dies, the most moral, the best of us. Ed later on kills somebody in cold blood and makes the decision to do it. Bobby's raped. He's not in any way to blame, but he's involved because of that. And then Lewis, very justifiably, kills the rapist. But then Drew is the only one that dies, so that's the way it goes, is that Ed seems to be the one who's the most haunted. We see him at the very end of the movie waking up from a bad dream, suggesting he's got PTSD. Like, he's a war veteran, and of course Vietnam was ending around this time, or coming to an end around the 70s. I guess when the book was written, actually, it was still in the hype. But anyway, the point is, he's got PTSD. Not to say that Bobby and Lewis won't too, but I think we've made the point already. Lewis will probably recover from this if he doesn't lose that leg, especially, and just be the Lewis he was before. Maybe even be tougher, because he does have a line early on, you gotta lose yourself before you can find anything. And, of course, you can't get lost on a river. It only goes one way. And then the guy who got raped, as bad as it was, it almost seems like Bobby can recover when he's hanging out with those very kindly mountain folks. Nice contrast, by the way. Early on, they got the hostile mountain folks when they first drive and they give their cars over. And that's a trusting thing, too. You don't even know these people. The Griner brothers are actually going to deliver your cars. They do. But at the end, when Ed and Bobby are having dinner with these people, Bobby's just trying to put a nice face on it, I guess, and maybe trying to distract everyone else and not let this guy be centered out. Ed, that is, when he starts crying at the dinner table. But this is the guy who, I guess it's maybe at that point 2 days later, maybe it's 3 days later, but only a few days ago, got anally raped by somebody. And I think that really, all things considered, he might come out of it okay. Although at the end, when he says, I don't think I'll see you for a while, to Ed, Bobby's never going to see Ed again.
I think he's just pushing his pain down. I mean, Ned Beatty is a really good actor, and this performance is phenomenal. When he's diffusing the drama at the dinner table, as you say, when Ed starts crying, I just see somebody who wants to change the subject, because if he gives into empathy, if he tries to help Ed feel it through, then he knows that he is going to unearth this well of pain and terror and his own PTSD. So what does he want to do? He just wants to avoid them. Didn't happen, and that's not a great way of coping either. We don't really know what's going to happen to him, but you watch the rape scene, and you watch what he goes through, and the trauma on his face during that event, and the humiliation of it, and everything is just so excruciating. There's no way somebody just recovers from that. He's always kind of the underdog in the group already, too.
He's the fat one.
He's the butt of their jokes, and Lewis is always yelling at him. So he already feels like he's the weak one. And he doesn't want any reminders of it. There could also be, in that scene, the fear that Ed is going to break down and tell everybody what happened. He might be like, I killed that man, and then their cover is blown, and he just wants to walk away from the situation and never think about it again.
And Bob even says, when they're discussing what to do about having just killed the guy, let's bury him. I don't want this getting around.
There's nothing he wants more than to have that whole day and all of its events be covered by billions of gallons of water be on the bottom of a very deep lake.
Talk about an interesting debut for a guy, because Ned Beatty and Ronnie Cox, this was their debut. This was a dangerous movie to shoot. They did all these stunts without insurance. Voight climbed the cliff towards the end of the film with that really awful day for night photography. But they did all these dangerous things, and for the two actors who weren't established stars, maybe Burt Reynolds wasn't quite a star yet, but Voight certainly was. And look at Ned Beatty's resume since. It might be the best of all these four guys. Nashville Network, All the President's Men, all AFI films. Also in Superman, Toy Story 3, the voice of the bad guy in that movie. He's had a great resume.
Yeah, initially they wanted to cast stars. The studio told them to cast stars, and so they cast Jack Nicholson as Ed and Marlon Brando as Lewis.
I also heard about Brando for Ed and Lee Marvin for Lewis.
Oh, okay, maybe I had that mixed up. A lot of names were thrown around when they were casting this film. And then the studio came back and said, no stars, you're going to have no budget. John Voight hadn't had a hit in a while, and he was thinking about leaving acting altogether. Burt Reynolds wasn't really a star. He had done some TV movies and some B-movies, but this was like his star-making role in Deliverance. Both Ronnie Cox and Ned Beatty were theater actors. That was their background. And their performances are amazing. But how do you convince any film actor with any name whatsoever to play Bobby? And Ned Beatty has said himself that for years after people would just yell at him on the street, squeal like a pig. He's like, people have always, for my entire life now, associated me with a rape victim. I tried like hell to find it. Apparently he wrote a very thoughtful article about this in the 80s in the New York Times about how the whole experience gave him this identification with rape victims and how they can never escape being victims.
The rape itself isn't as graphic as you might imagine or even remember. There's no thrusting shown. When the mountain man first enters him, he probably should be pushing him forward because, you know, I don't want to get too graphic here, but when you watch that part before they cut away, because most of the actual fucking happens off screen, which is very smart, you get the gist of what's happening, but you hear him squeeze, squeeze, squeeze over and over again, and when it's the, from that baby, that's God. Of course the moment of insertion. But you don't really see anything happen beyond that. You do see Ed's reaction, and by the way, one of my favorite touches in the whole sequence, Mountain Man who does the raping comes back, the other guy, the dumb one with the gun, then they're obviously going to do something to Ed, and it's that, you got a pretty mouth, you better pray, boy, you better pray good. Ed's still holding his pipe, and it's almost like he's defiantly raising it up, and then the guy just knocks it out of his hand. And that's almost as if to say, okay, your urbane lifestyle can take a shit because it's a pipe. What the fuck are you with a pipe out here?
Seriously.
But I don't think Ed's actually trying to do anything with it. It's more just he's happened to have it in his hand.
The events happen so quickly, you can imagine that they are going from, we can negotiate with these guys, I'm sure that we can talk ourselves out of this situation,
what do you require?
To suddenly, like, my friend is getting raped, and I'm being held by the throat by a belt, and I very well may be dead, unless an incredible stroke of luck saves him, which is
what
happens.
They surely would have killed them, as they said.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This could be the end, and it happened so quickly, so he's still holding his pipe. And the whole scene is more or less meant to be from Ed's perspective, because he is the star of the film. He was the narrator of the book, and whether or not he was a cipher, you say that Lewis was a cipher for James Dickey, but he is the narrator of the book, and this is about his journey of becoming a murderer. You said a little while ago, and I disagree with you, we disagree about this, you said that he kills the mountain man in cold blood, but I don't say it's cold blood. I think they really were in danger. I think that that guy was stalking them, and that he had aimed to hurt him.
It's very intelligent the way that Borman does it. He casts the guy who plays the man on the top of the cliff that Voight climbs towards the end. Is it the same guy who's got the fake teeth that are in there where the guy that was with the other mountain man had the gun ran away? That guy's got no front teeth. So the other guy's got fake teeth. Is it the right guy? He looks similar to him, but I don't think it's the same guy. And I like the idea that it's not necessarily supposed to be the same guy. They're so paranoid. Of course this guy's out to get us. How could he not be?
But if that was a different actor, wouldn't we have known about that? Is there another actor listed in the credits as the Mountain Man?
Well, you saw the movie only a few days ago. Do you think it's the exact same actor?
Yeah.
Herbert Cowboy Coward?
Yeah. They have a story online about what it was like when he was getting lowered by the rope off the side of the cliff and how he was drunk when that was happening. And
oh, yeah?
I didn't read that. You're talking about Cowboy. Yeah, it's the same actor. What kind of a coincidence would it be for there to be another Mountain Man who also was missing the same teeth, wearing a very similar outfit and look very similar, also has a double-barrel shotgun?
They took the gun away. He doesn't have that gun.
Doesn't
when
he
runs away. That's the whole thing. Ed grabs it after the arrow goes through the other guy, and then he runs, and Drew comes up with a paddle. You better run, you son of a bitch!
Oh, so he went and got another gun and came back and looked for them then.
If you want to believe that, I like that the movie's open enough to suggest my view on it or your view on it.
Yeah, I do
it
agree.
Isn't guaranteed,
it is,
and these guys are that paranoid, maybe deservedly, but the whole thing about Drew was shot, Ed, Drew was shot, that Lewis insists, there's no gunshot that comes from the cliff, even though it's loud. You don't hear a gunshot by any means. And also, when they find Drew's body, he clearly wasn't shot in the head or anywhere else for that matter.
I don't think that's even that ambiguous, because when you watch him exit the canoe, if he's meant to have been shot and fallen out, then that is a terrible bit of physical acting. First of all, he refuses to put his life jacket on. Mm-hmm. Why? Because he's suicidal. He's in shock. He's having a mental breakdown when they're burying the body. He's freaking out, hyperventilating. And then he won't put his life jacket on. He won't answer anybody, and they call him repeatedly. He gets up, and he jumps out of the canoe. It seems really obvious to me. The first time I saw it, when Lewis is saying over and over he was shot, I was like, who was shot? Drew was shot. When was Drew shot? After he jumped out of the canoe? I paid pretty close attention the second time watching it, and I am thoroughly convinced that Drew had a complete mental breakdown. The performance of, what's his name, Bill McKinley, the guy who plays
McKinney.
The mountain, McKinney, thank you, the rapist. His performance of dying?
One of the best death scenes
ever.
Oh my
god. It's so real.
And he doesn't move when he's dead on that branch with the arrow through him. He plays the death scene, and a lot of it's shot with him not on camera, but a lot of it's shot with him on camera, that great debate, which had to have been influenced by the Treasure of the Sierra Madre, but those guys discuss when that guy comes across them when they're mining for gold. Well, we either let him be part of this, we kill him, or what's the third option again?
Let him go, and then he'll tell
us. Right, and then he'll tell us. Right, there's three options there. And this scene is the very same kind of thing where it's just three, well, four in this case, guys discussing what do we do? And they're all bad options. And one of them is about blatantly killing somebody, or in this case, actually covering up the murder. And I think in both movies' cases, I understand why they go down that road.
Yeah, and they all side with Lewis except for Drew. But Drew is the only one that doesn't stand to lose anything by going to the authorities. Because he didn't take part in the murder. He wasn't a victim of the initial rape and tormenting. He just kind of showed up after the fact and has to choose between siding with his friends and helping them cover up a murder or going and seeking out the authorities and maybe being a witness in a trial, but he's not going to prison for anything.
No, Lewis suggests, and he may be right, that in a kangaroo court situation like that, that they'd all go to jail. Not just Lewis.
It's a risk, but he's a pretty happy-go-lucky, sweet guy who believes the best of people. So you can see how he would think that's just an exaggeration, trying to convince him not to do the right thing. He wants to do the right thing, and I'm using air quotes right now, because the right thing was to kill that man. And they cannot trust the justice system down there. So, to be honest, if I was in that situation, I would probably side with Lewis, too. I'd probably be like, let's bury this body. Let's get the hell out of here. Pretend it never happened. This is the best possible outcome. I don't want to take my chances with these people. As a matter of fact, I just want to get as far away from this place as humanly possible.
Go home and watch the football game.
Yeah.
That same summer, there was another brutal rape movie that came out, although that was a girl that got raped, and that was Last House on the Left. Now, I haven't seen the original one in a long time. I did see the remake again not that long ago. Pretty vivid remake, actually. But in the original, I think it is more graphic with the actual rape and the thrusting and all that stuff. Like I say, they mostly don't show Beatty's trauma, just the beginning of it. But then that's more effective anyway, the whole stroking the face. Then Bridges 2, and then squee! The whole build-up. You know what's going to happen, or at least you can guess what's going to happen. You don't really need to see what does happen. The remake of Last House on the Left that I just saw not long ago was more of a matter-of-fact stabbing of one of the girls, and then the other one's just, well, fuck it, let's just rape her and kill her kind of thing. And that's part of the whole point of that movie. It's the shocking, just out of nowhere it happens. I don't know about the original, I haven't seen that one in a long time. But in both Last House on the Left and Deliverance that same year, the horror, which happens to be rape in both cases, happens in broad daylight, not at night, when most horror in any movie that's got some kind of horrific sequence happens.
I don't know about Last House on the Left because I've never seen it, but to me, part of the intensity of the rape scene in Deliverance is just how quickly it builds up. It's almost surreal how intense it gets so fast. And but, yeah, like you said, in the daytime, like you expect a rape to just have sinister, dark shadows.
Any horror, because that is a horror moment, no different than Jason Voorhees or Michael Myers or Freddy Krueger, really. Real horror. All right, so let's get back to the beginning of the film, because that is where the joyful sequence happens.
Okay.
We're out of sequence here, and we got motorcycles going by everywhere. So when they arrive and they're playing dueling banjos, is Drew unknowingly consorting with the enemy when playing dueling banjos?
But why is that kid the enemy?
The movie is suggesting that everybody down there is the enemy. Although that's not really true, is it? Because at the end, the people are nice to Ed and Bobby. The cops are suspicious, but then the cops are fair. It's not like they just say, kangaroo court style, well, you obviously did something, so you're guilty.
And the brothers really did drive their cars.
Brothers, that's true.
Yeah, and they're surprised. When they get there, they're like, oh, they really brought the cars here. Look, they really were good guys.
But there's also the hostility of all the people around. And who's picking the banjo here? Although I like the touch that four or five guys come out just to watch the dueling banjos as if that's their only entertainment they'll get for a long time.
It might be.
And it is a lot of fun. I've watched that sequence probably 30 or 40 times on the DVD, on the Blu-ray, and on YouTube over my lifetime. I'll probably watch another 30 or 40 before I die.
And it's a great portrayal of musicians taking pure joy in performing a song. And I agree, it's very joyful. Another example of them underestimating the locals, too. They look at that kid and they're rolling their eyes like, look at this dummy. And then he's not just a great banjo player, but at the end, Drew saying,
I'm lost. Okay,
I'm lost. You beat me. You win. This kid is a better player than me.
Mister, I love the way you wear that hat. You don't know nothing. That is such a great sequence in all levels. Everybody's great in that opening moment. But then, from the beginning of the film, there are constant warning signs of danger. There's the hostility from those guys in the beginning, the locals. The kid, after the dueling banjo thing, does refuse the handshake, but he's also standing on that bridge when they pass underneath, and that Apocalypse Now-esque camera shot, although Apocalypse Now came 7 years later, but where the camera follows and turns as it goes underneath the bridge, and the kid acts like he's never seen these people before.
Hey, he's just staring them down. It's really rather ominous.
And that's a sign of danger. Then the rapids, of course, are a dangerous thing. And then the snake going through the river, which is not long before they come across a guy with a more dangerous snake, the mountain man. When they're riding the rapids, the four of them, especially Bobby, seem to be legitimately thrilled to have achieved it. And I wonder if the actors' reactions were unscripted.
Yeah, probably. It seems so believable. It just seems so natural and real. And they really did ride those rapids, and they really were inexperienced boaters who probably were impressed and surprised that they could get through those rapids.
Oh, by the way, getting back to the rape scene, a few more notes I have here that I really wanted to get to. Had Ed and Bobby not been inquisitive about the mountain men, right? Because they see them there and they go and they ask them questions. Or if they had just stopped a few hundred feet further. It's one of those moments in the movie where you just say, just a little bit different. In Psycho, if Marion Crane had just decided not to stop at the Bates Motel, either parked on the side of the road or gone to another motel, but there really weren't other options that way. And of course, she'd been harassed by a cop for stopping on the side of the road a few days ago. But the point is, it's one of those things in a movie that points out in life, the slightest little thing, the butterfly effect idea, that if you'd just done that one little thing differently, how your life could have changed. And then you've got the cliche of the American hick raping the erudite, well-to-do city slickers. Why they're doing this is they're washing away an entire town to provide electricity to the privileged. Mm-hmm. This isn't a necessity in the way that you have to do this. It's a choice. And again, it's not Ed and Bobby and Drew and Lewis's fault that this is happening, but it's people like them that are causing this trauma to happen to the people that are the rapists.
Yeah, and these shanties that are getting drowned probably don't have power anyway. They probably don't even enjoy electricity down there.
All right. So the main star, Ed John Voight, who doesn't need to go to prison because he's going to be tormented forever. He's in his own prison. No lockup's going to do the same thing to him. But John Voight, he'd been in Midnight Cowboy before this, an AFI movie we covered. And then Ali as Howard Cosell and many others. I mean, all these actors have been in a ton of movies. Actually, the numbers on this could have been my trivia question, but I've gone this route before with other four-actor movies like this one. But John Voight's been in 57 movies, and he's still working. Burt Reynolds in 97. Ned Beatty in 79, and Ronnie Cox is the fewest with only 37. He's the one who seems to have been at least somewhat retired. He hasn't had a credit in a few years now, and he's mostly done TV anyway. But Voight is effective in the lead, and I think we've talked about him the least of the four actors. If you were to nominate anybody from this film for Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, would it be Voight?
I would say Beatty for Supporting Actor. I like Voight. Mm-hmm. Looking at the list of actors that could have played Ed, Jack Nicholson, Robert Redford, imagine, that would have been amazing.
Would have liked to have seen Brando actually take on the Ed role, not the Lewis role.
Yeah, except they never would have made the film with Brando.
Right.
With a $2 million budget and all of his shenanigans, it just never would have happened. It would have completely sunk the movie to the bottom of the river.
And he wouldn't have been in The Godfather either, and that would have been worse. Yeah, he wasn't in that.
I liked John Voight a lot. There's a couple moments, like him playing drunk, which he's terrible at. But then there's other moments, like when he starts crying at the dinner table at the end, that are so incredibly believable and natural, or his shock and disbelief when he's tied to the tree. John Borman did an incredible job. He said that he does tons of rehearsals. They don't shoot very many takes. He's very proud of saying that he has the lowest shooting to final cut ratio. He doesn't shoot very much film. The camera's rolling. Chances are it's going to make it in the cut.
Impressive for a movie like this.
No kidding. I guess they had to do it that way because of the budget, but he does tons of rehearsals, and it must pay off because there's just moment after moment of breathtaking performances. And yeah, John Voight has some amazing moments. You think he should have got nominated for like a Best Actor?
I'm just speculating right now. I haven't really given a ton of thought because it'd be a hard movie to give nominations to. There really should be an award at the Oscars for Best Cast.
The SAG Awards does that, yeah.
Where it might be 10 or 12 or even more people, and I guess when that happens, they'll go on stage and say, thank you for this award, and one person probably does all the speaking. And I guess you could argue that Best Picture at the Oscars is that, because everyone goes on the stage. But there are movies where you've got four actors, and of course The Godfather was the same year, so that would have been the winner of that award anyway. But these four actors, in their own roles, all very different people. Of course, they represent a dichotomy of society, although they're all four white men. But that was the 70s, so sorry. But
it's a movie about class systems, so it's fair, it's fine.
You do see a few black guys, but pretty much it's just white people in the whole film. Yeah.
But to your point about casts in general getting rewarded, you know, there's all these great stories about how they actually blocked and rehearsed the rape scene between McKinney and Beatty and Voight and the other actor. They improvised the line, squeal like a pig, and how they physically figured out the blocking of the scene, how he was going to chase him around and where they would end up, and it would be Ed's point of view. That was all work that they did together, and how would you credit one actor or another with all the decisions that were made in that scene when it's really about how they work together as an ensemble?
Drew, Bobby, and Lewis all seem to be three separate friends of Ed's. I never really picked up on that before until we watched it this time. Lewis doesn't seem to know Bobby or Drew all that well, maybe, but also Bobby does say, that friend of yours, not that friend of ours. Not that bullying friend of mine, it's your friend, Ed. But then also Bobby says about Drew, and they give him that little eulogy when they sink him with the rocks so he'll be buried underneath the water, just like the mountain men, forever and ever, they hope at least. Bobby says he never really knew Drew.
You knew him, I didn't.
So it's not really that Bobby and Drew were friends. They seem that they could have been. It almost seems like it's Ed's three separate friends getting together for this weekend retreat. Although, one of the taglines at least was that this is the weekend they didn't play golf.
Because there's a line where he says, let's just go play golf, when the guy's warning them against the river. Why you want to go fuck with that river? Because it's there.
But I... Yeah, right, another man of the
machismo. And it is clear in the movie that both Bobby and Drew are the inexperienced one. And that's why Lewis and Ed can never be in the same canoe. When you're in a canoe, it's always the more experienced one that goes in the behind. Back, yeah. It goes in the back, yeah.
Which I don't think in any way the movie's suggesting this is some kind of subtext. But the man in charge, the man with the power, is behind the other man. Which is what happens in the red letter scene in this whole movie.
Maybe that's it. It's accidentally appropriate.
By the way, these four actors are obviously not very young men anymore. Beatty and Reynolds are in their 80s. Cox and Voight are almost in their 80s. And except for Cox, they're all still working pretty regularly. Their resumes are big. Like I said, Reynolds has 97 movies to his credit, although so much junk. But that guy was a huge star in the 70s, starting with this movie and then beyond. Smokey and the Bandit was the pinnacle of the 70s for him, despite having a lot of other big hits, including The End. I think that was a pretty decent-sized hit. But then his resurgence with Boogie Nights in 1997, a movie I didn't love the first time I saw it, but I've liked it more ever since, and the more I see it, the more I like him in that movie. He can be a great actor. It's unfortunate that he kind of tossed his career away, although he had some kind of sickness in the 80s, too, and then people just turned away from him. Apparently they thought he had AIDS, and everyone ran away from him or something. But he's still hanging on and still doing movies of some kind, at least, and who knows, maybe he'll still put out one more great performance. He was both a movie star and a pretty good actor, and not a lot of people that are movie stars are necessarily good actors.
And a strappingly handsome man.
Like we said earlier,
with a great, thick chest of hair.
The tormentor, Bill McKinney, the rapist, was in some pretty good movies. The L.O. Josie Wales, only a couple years after this, and First Blood, the first Rambo movie. Back to the Future Part 3, Green Mile, all interesting credits, but he could have been the drill sergeant in Full Metal Jacket, which we talked about not that long ago, but Stanley Kubrick was afraid to meet him. I guess Stanley Kubrick thought the guy wasn't acting in this movie and that John Borman just turned a camera on and they got lucky with the rape scene.
That's why I was thinking about Full Metal Jacket, because we did that movie so recently. It has really similar themes to Deliverance, because they're both movies about that push and pull between a man's desire to kill, be violent, commit violence, then to cope with the consequences of violence, and how you can have in one person both of those things, the desire and the fear of violence.
Mm-hmm. And the other mountain man who survives, and maybe at the end, the one that gets shot through the throat with the arrow, Herbert Cowboy Coward, was only in one other movie, and it was called Ghost Town, the movie. Bill McKinney was in that as well. And if I were to ever have a list of my own favorite 50 villains, I've said so many great villains and so many great heroes for that matter, that are or are not on the AFI's version of that list, but I always thought the mountain men should have been there somewhere. They're barely in the movie, but they're so effective.
Oh god, they're so sinister.
They're still raping somebody, but their point of view being that you guys are ruining this town for us, you're destroying us, maybe even killing people.
Yeah, it's funny, we very often talk in movies about how you could make the same movie from the point of view of the villain
and like, right.
Sympathize with the villain, but that is not true in this movie.
Yeah, you still shouldn't rape these guys.
I don't see any situation where you're like, yeah, rape them. No.
And they would have killed them. I think that's very
true. Oh, yeah, absolutely. They would have been dead men for sure.
Their director and producer, John Boorman, who had made Point Blank in the late 60s before this, pretty good movie. If you haven't seen it, you should check it out, you and also our audience. And then Excalibur, several years later, and Hope and Glory might be one of his better movies in the 80s. But his resume is weird. He's also got Zardoz on there with Sean Connery, and he directed Exorcist II, The Heretic, which is a lambasted sequel of the classic Exorcist. So he's made great films like Deliverance, Point Blank, and then Hope and Glory is pretty good, but then other trash.
It's funny you mention Excalibur, because when the hand comes out of the lake in Ed's Nightmare at the end, it reminds me of the hand bringing the sword out of the lake.
Sure, the Lady of the Lake, yeah. Well, that's also clearly an influence on Carrie, which was an influence on Friday the 13th, with that last scare, the hand coming out of the rocks in Carrie, and then the decrepit boy himself coming out of the water at the end of Friday the 13th. Great scares in all three cases, although more so the horror movies than this one. It's not really a scare, it's more like a scare for Ed.
And it's layered with meaning, because it could mean one of two things. It could mean, is Ed afraid that the mountain man is really alive, and that they're going to come back and keep stalking him, or that he killed the wrong guy and there's still somebody out to get him?
Yeah.
Or is Ed afraid that a corpse is going to float up to the top of that lake and they'll suddenly have to be held responsible for what they did that weekend?
Either Drew or the mountain man.
And both of those things could and should terrify him.
There's a great poster, I don't know if it was released in the 70s, because it came before Jaws, but it's the rifle being pointed at a canoe with three guys in it.
Yeah, and it comes up like Jaws at the bottom of the shot.
The canoe is the girl.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guy with the gun is the shark.
The lake is the same horizon point in the poster, yeah.
Maybe that came after the Jaws poster did, because that is one of the greatest posters of all time, the Jaws one is. We talked about James Dickey writing the book and also the screenplay, and his dialogue was uncreditedly edited by John Boorman. And in the book, it explains that they wanted, quote-unquote, deliverance from the stresses of modern life, and they sure got that.
And then there's nothing they want more than modern life at the end when Lewis's leg is broken and they just need to see a doctor. And Lewis, who's the one who wants away from modern life more than anybody.
But would have died had it not
been without intervention from civilization. It's a great touch in the film that it's not the tough guy that saves them. He's felled by just an accident. That could have happened to him regardless of the mountain men.
Yeah.
They could have been going down those same rapids.
And they would have been going down the same rapids.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. He could have broken his leg under any of those circumstances.
And they were in trouble because when Drew fell out of the canoe, everyone panicked. And also then Ed didn't have a front man to help them get down there. But maybe they would have had a problem anyway. Could have been the same problem. Would have been a different kind of problem because there would have been no panic about somebody trying to kill them.
Mm-hmm.
But that paranoia at the end, I think, makes that whole sequence. If you want to believe it was actually the other mountain men that was trying to kill them. But then still, even if that's the logic on this, the sheriff suspects them. You gotta wonder, because let's say you just committed a murder somewhere and you feel like you got away with it, but did you really get away with it? If you have a conscience, then that should bother you for the rest of your life.
And it will bother Ed for the rest of his life.
It will.
I like how when they're in the end of the rapids, Lewis, they propped him up on the rock and he has to climb the cliff and he says, you know, are we gonna die here? And because the movie's already gone so far, because it's already shown audiences something that I think in 1972, I don't think there's that many movies that show something that viscerally violent as the rape scene. So watching it myself the first time, I had no idea if they were going to make it out alive or not. I really didn't know. And I believe that movie would have killed our heroes because it had already done so much crazy stuff.
Makes for a great movie then if it actually makes you feel that way.
Oh, it's so, so effective.
And a 70s movie maybe would have killed them. All right, the film is 2-3-5-2-1 and it's a sparkling Blu-ray transfer. I really liked it a lot. The cameraman, Vilmos Zsigmond, who shot 71 movies in his career, so that's a ton there. McCabe and Mrs. Miller was the year before this. Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which he won an Oscar for, and The Deer Hunter were later in the 70s. Obviously, he shot a lot of movies in total, but those four are a career for anybody.
Wasn't he a war photographer or something?
I believe he and Laszlo Kovacs, who shot Easy Rider and many others, came over together from Hungary or Czechoslovakia or one of those kinds of, what do you call them, Eastern Bloc countries?
Yeah.
And then had a great career in Hollywood and got lucky they got the hell out of there.
And that's why Boorman hired him, because he's like, oh, I need someone who's just not going to lose his cool even when shit is hitting the fan.
He's lucky his actors, too, and the whole crew didn't just bail on him after some of the
he's
stuff
he went
through.
He's lucky nobody actually broke their leg.
Hmm.
They had no insurance, and that's why there's a joke in the movie about how, you know,
insurance.
Lewis's car isn't insured. I don't believe in insurance. There's no risk that way. Yeah, because your film doesn't have insurance, and if you, like, millions of dollars down the toilet if you fail.
And it isn't his fault, but that Day for Night filter stuff they use when Ed climbs the cliff looks like the 50s. Looks like Shane or From Here to Eternity still doesn't work right.
And maybe they could have done something better if they had a budget. And I know it's the 70s. They didn't really have the technology then.
They were on location, too.
And they were on location. Yeah, you would need a lot of money to make that happen. So that was the compromise that they had to make, which is a shame because, good God, that Day for Night stuff is some of the ugliest I've ever seen.
The editor was Tom Priestley, who cut 1984 and then Exorcist 2 for John Boorman. The music score credit is interesting. There isn't really one. But then the Golden Globe nomination for Dueling Banjos as a song was for Arthur Smith, Steve Mandel, and Eric Weisberg. So I guess the song is those guys, but I don't know who did the score specifically. There's not a whole lot of music apart from playing off of the Dueling Banjos. You hear that mournful refrain of it two or three different times as it goes along, including at the very end of the film. The song, by the way, is not an original. It was written in the 50s and was used on The Andy Griffith Show, of all things. Although, then again, that makes sense. I say that as if to say, in a rape movie, but when that song is played, it is Andy Griffith-esque. It's this perfect little encapsulation of joy with these various men enjoying the song. And that one guy, who's picking the banjo here? You see him later on is whistling along.
That was a choice that Boorman made to save money as well. I mean, it was the right choice. I think it really works in the film. But it's not like a symphony orchestra and a composer was ever going to fit into their budget anyway.
And how about the word dueling? Because even though they're having fun at that moment, these two societies are clashing and dueling.
It's a competition.
Yeah. Mm. There's a lot of influence from Deliverance on other movies. Stand By Me has a similar deer and main character encounter when you see Ed go out trying to hunt by himself. I like that Lewis, by the way, Mr. Tough Guy, is asleep almost like a little kid, and Ed can't wake him up. Ed goes out and tries to shoot a deer, but can't do it. Later on, has to shoot the guy, and does, but almost fails in the same kind of way. Well, Stand By Me, not about shooting the deer, but Gordy sees it and never tells anyone else about having seen this deer and having this connection with it. In both cases, they're kind of connecting with nature. And who doesn't know about squeal like a pig? Squee! Squee! That's been done to death for so many years. Probably even now people are parodying it somewhere. People actually drowned in the Chattooga River attempting the same canoe trip. Reminds me of Fargo, where the woman tried to find the money that wasn't actually there and died.
You don't think of snow as dangerous, where Deliverance makes that river look crazy dangerous. Like, what do people think was going to happen? But, oh my god, isn't that human nature? Mm. That's exactly what the film's portraying human nature is. The more dangerous, the better. The higher the risk, the better. All right, you wackos.
Yeah.
Just do it because it's there.
Thinning the herd a little bit when they died, I guess. Pulp Fiction has a similar blend of humor and fun, the Dueling Banjos sequence.
And an anal rape.
And then eventually, yeah, we get brutality, for one thing, and blood and guts and everything. Well, not really blood and guts, I guess. Actually, both movies are fairly good about that, aren't they? There's not really that much blood in either movie. But yes, anal rape. And then here's what I thought about when we were watching the movie. Bear with me. The Hangover.
I'm bearing. Go on.
Three guys are in serious danger after a fucked up previous day, and they lose the dull friend.
Drew wasn't the dull one, was he? He wasn't the Doug.
He was the Doug.
Doug is the worst. Why does he Doug? Why?
That may be a comedy, but there are some similarities. They're in very serious danger in The Hangover, as they certainly are in Deliverance. All right, the awards and list section. There were 3 Oscar nominations for Best Picture up against The Godfather, Best Director up against, I guess, Cabaret, because that went to Bob Fosse, and the editing. Didn't win any of those. The screenplay wasn't nominated. And of course, none of the actors or cinematography. The movie was put in the National Film Registry in 2008, and that was a weaker group than usual in the registry, but it did include In Cold Blood and The Terminator. That's a pretty good threesome of movies, and one of those might get reviewed by us very soon, in fact, in a couple of weeks, In Cold Blood. Deliverance was 15th on the Top 100 Thrills, Psycho was number 1, and it was nominated for the Top 100 Quotes with, "I bet you could squeal like a pig," which is the quote the guy actually says, but I guess just squee in general, squee, squee, is the quote people really think about when they think about that scene. All right, well then, final thoughts on our final movie in July, Deliverance.
This film is a classic. It's thoughtful, painfully effective, and it still feels very essential. If you haven't seen it in a while, revisit it. It really rewards multiple viewings.
It's not one of the all-time best 70s movies as in the top 3 or 4. It's not Godfather, Taxi Driver, it isn't registered like that. But it's in the top 50 of 70s movies, or top 25 maybe even. And it's one I've seen many times. I've watched it when I watched The Godfather.
It's like a See Before You Die movie. I do think it's an essential film that everybody should see if they are filmophiles.
And there were a lot of interesting movies in 72. The Poseidon Adventure, which I happened to watch last week, is nowhere near in the category of The Godfather, Cabaret, or Deliverance. But it's interesting in its own right. They're all very different films, but of all those movies, including The Godfather, the one I've watched the most is Deliverance.
Oh, really?
I've seen The Godfather maybe 5 times. I've seen Deliverance. It's got to be 6 or 7 times by now.
For the agony of watching it and how effective it is highly watchable. I think we failed to compliment how entertaining it is, but also how well the tension is played out. It's a thrilling film.
Mm-hmm. Belongs on the throws list. It is 15th. All right, then. The Civic Holiday is next week, but we'll be on the job with a special episode. We've been taking a lot of weeks off lately, so we'll actually have an episode on a holiday. Instead of covering one flick that day, we're going to gab about some of the worst movies we've ever seen. I already have a bottom 10 list in mind with some honorable mentions, and I'm sure Bev has more than a few of her own. These won't be the obvious choices necessarily.
Oh, I'm planning on making some enemies.
For me, it's some of the memories I had in the theater seeing them and being fucking mad at the time, hating the movie or hating the people around me. So maybe the movies weren't even all that bad, and maybe I should watch them again, give them another chance kind of thing. But in that moment, I hated them, and in most cases, I've never seen them a second time. But we'll talk about that next week. I think we are better at being acerbic than being effusive.
Effusive is boring. That's the problem. There's only like so many ways you can say how much you love something, but when you hate something, that's when you get really creative.
That's part of the problem with picking movies you want to watch when you do a Next 100 project. It's not movies foisted on you by the AFI. We've mostly picked movies we both liked. A few, like Blackboard Jungle, were just on TV and we watched them, and then, not as good maybe as we hope they might be. But most of these movies have been ones we've liked, so let's get into ones we hate. We're also going to dust off the email bag and answer some of your most pressing questions. Now, by the time Deliverance here gets posted, we'll have already recorded the podcast, so it's a moot point, but we hope you got your questions in so we can maybe put them in that podcast. We're not big email answerers, but we're going to try to do it while we're sitting at the lake recording that podcast. There's no trivia for that one. No coming attractions trivia for the worst movies.
All right, so please check out next week's podcast. where we probably make you angry about our opinions. But in the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. Rate us. Review us. It only takes a minute, and it helps people find us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email. We'd love to hear from you. Top100ProjectPodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, SparkplugCoffee.com.
You don't know nothing.
And cut.